scientists with minimal political interference. Sounds like a good idea, if you're a scientist. But he was opposed by someone named Holly Kilgore, who had become a senator of West Virginia. He challenged a man by the name of Rush Holt. Some of you may know the name Rush Holt. Rush is Rush Holt Senior. So Kilgore has a great distaste for Bush. Kilgore graduated from the University of West Virginia. He was not an elitist, and he thought that Bush represented the Northeast elites. Well, it was also the California branch. But Bush basically had Roosevelt here, and so what Bush wanted was unhappy. Then Roosevelt died, 1945. Truman becomes president. Harley Kilgore, when he became a senator, joined the Senate Committee on Military Affairs. Who was the chairman of that committee when he first joined in 1942? Harry Truman. So Kilgore knew Truman. By the way, Truman had no idea who the hell Benjamin Bush was, because Roosevelt had kept Truman out of the loop on everything. Truman didn't even know about the Manhattan Project. Didn't know Bush. So Kilgore goes to Truman and said, don't pay any attention to Bush. So for 5 years after the war ended, even though Bush had recommended, said that would be called National Science Foundation today, Kilgore persuaded Truman to veto the legislation. And nothing happened until Truman finally turned to somebody in his cabinet named John Steelman, and he said, tell me what's going on. And Steelman went back and looked at both Bush and Kilgore, and he developed something that became the structure for American science in the post-World War II era. So on the little bit of earth that this year Bush is being celebrated, and Steelman, who in large measure was really responsible for what happened, is completely ignored. All right, let's move ahead. So here are a few people that you probably recognize. Eisenhower, Kennedy, and Nixon. If I asked you to select the name of one of those three as being prominent in the support of American science, whom would you pick? Let's start with the first, Eisenhower. Raise your hand. Kennedy. Everybody's got a vote. So we're going to do it again. Eisenhower, who's your Eisenhower? Kennedy. Nixon. All right, I'll tell you the real story. And what's amazing about Eisenhower is that he had a passion for science. He actually believed in space exploration, not for military purposes, but for knowledge. He's also the person on the technology side who said we need to have what became the interstate highway system. Because in 1919, he traveled with the military across the country and saw how wretched the roads were. And then during the Second World War, he saw how wonderful the Autobahn was. So he started that because of his interest really in technology. Kennedy basically inherited what Eisenhower had started. And then, of course, Nixon did a lot of good things at the beginning. Now let me just tell you. So Truman runs, and he wins in an upset, upsetting Tom Dewey. Some of you may remember the Chicago newspaper headline, Dewey wins, and it turned out not to be true. 4 years later, 1952, of course, is the Korea issue. There were also scandals in Washington, not that Truman was involved in them, but his administration was hard for them. His approval rating had sunk to 25%. So he knows he ain't going to win. So he goes back to Eisenhower. They have lunch at the Blair House. And once again, he proposes to Eisenhower, we'll get you the Democratic nomination for President. Eisenhower says, well, I've been a Republican all my life. I am not going to run for president as a Democrat. Besides, I'm president of Columbia University. I'm on leave, and I'm in Paris running Nathan. So don't even think about it. Well, he's there, 1952, the Republican convention is going to take place. And the person who was the leading candidate was Bob Taft from Ohio, who had zero interest in science. He was more of an isolationist. And he had the support of most Republicans, except for some of the people around on the East Coast. Lucius Clay, who had been Ike's number two the year of after the war ended. Tom Dewey. And Herb Brownell, who had been chair of the Republican National Republican Committee. And they were mortally afraid of what would happen if Bob Taft had become president. These people were globalists. These people were interested in science and technology. They knew that Taft would be reputable. How do you get Eisenhower to run? They knew he turned down Truman. So they recognized one thing. If there was one person in the world that Eisenhower thought would be an absolute disaster, would be a threat, it was Douglas MacArthur, who had won the Pacific Campaign during the Second World War. MacArthur, Truman had fired for his coordination, but MacArthur remained extraordinarily popular. Popularity is about 75%. He was also an extraordinary speaker, and he's going to give a keynote address at the Republican Convention. So these three guys, Clay, Dewey, and Brownell, contact Eisenhower and say, if you don't run for president, MacArthur's going to be the next president. And Eisenhower said, okay, all right. And that's the reason he ran. Took several ballots before he got the nomination. But that's why we have Eisenhower, had Eisenhower, rather than he would have, probably would have. And, but they built that up. Okay. Let me move forward. So Nixon had destroyed almost all of the mechanisms in Washington having to do with science. He eliminated the position of science advisor, which he wrote director of the Office of Science and Technology Policy today. He basically got rid of anybody who could give scientific advice because he didn't like the advice he was getting. So, of course, Nixon leaves. The Senate didn't have to vote on his impeachment, it split four. And Gerald Ford became president, and then he sought to rebuild this apparatus, this wonderful thing, the great science and technology work in Washington. But he pardoned Nixon, and he lost the 1976 election to Jimmy Carter. Carter was an engineer, a nuclear engineer, but didn't quite get it. He liked to micromanage everything. He didn't need any advisory committees. He didn't need anything. He just made decisions. Not giving things he did. But Carter was, at least, an honorable person. Anyway, Carter loses in 1980. Ronald Reagan becomes president. Reagan had very little interest in science and technology. So everything just kind of stalls. In 1988, George H.W. Bush is elected president, and one of the people he knew quite well is Alan Brown. Alan was the director of the Wright Institute of Structural Laboratory at Yale, and was also heavily involved in the new rationale for science and technology beyond war and disease. It was economics. Alan and I got together in the late 1990s and did some exploration of what economists said. Robert Sarlo got the Nobel Prize for pointing out that research and development had been the prime driver of economic growth, supported later, and he got the Nobel Prize for that in 1982. Actually, not even earlier. Michael Boston at Stanford, Lawrence Lau, and Edmund Mansour all wrote about this. And nobody paid any attention. So in 1997, we had a symposium in Washington, actually, more press conference, and we raised this prospect. C-SPAN was where you got all your political stuff in. There was no Fox News, no C-SPAN, no MSNBC, whatever. And so they were on that. And we enlisted the support of a few prominent people in the Senate. Phil Graham, who had an engineer on the staff, and Alan knew Phil Graham very well. Joe Lee, who was somebody I had actually written to in the defense policy for 1988, and knew Joe very well. Bill Frist and Jay Rockefeller. Alan knew Frist, I knew Rockefeller. And so we got these guys together and made a recommendation that we want to double the science budget for the United States over a 10-year period. That was only 7% solution. So the bills passed. These were aspirational bills. They didn't really do more. I can get into it. They made it gritty. But I want to move forward to something else, which is, that, to me, one of the most fascinating stories in all of science and technology policy. And it involves the human genome. Any of you here are biologists or physical science? So there are a cast of characters. Francis Collins, I'd love to ask for that. Ari Petrinos and Alan Bradley. These were people who, Collins had the NIH piece of it, Petrinos, the DOE piece of it. And by the way, the Human Genome Project began as a congressional earmark. Senator Pete Manchin put that in to defend the Department of Energy budget. That's where the Genome Project began. And then Alan Bradley, who was with the Sanger Institute in the UK. Then there's Greg Bender, who came into this thing somewhat later and with a bunch of private investors in a company that he worked at home. Bender is I have not met Bradley, but I've met the others. Without question, Bender has, when Bender's in a room, you know he's there. And there's stories about Bender's early life, which are in the book, but I won't go through them. Anyway, he's got a leg up when he comes in. He came in with about 6 years into this whole project, but he has access to all of the public program. But he's not sharing it with anybody else. So they're racist. And he and Collins particularly are at each other's throats. Well, things got really out of hand. It was very clear if the vendor had won the race to basically decode the human genome, there'd be a lot of questions asked, why does the federal government spend money on something the private sector can do better and faster? On the other hand, if Collins, the immediate president, won, vendors, private investors would have been furious and would have created a big, big problem in the private sector. So, Bill Clinton turns to Neil Lane, the science advisor, and he says, Neil, go fix it. It's a mess. You got to figure out what to do. So what happens? Lane had a three-part plan. Number one, there'd be a White House event in the East Wing, in the East Room, and both Venter and Collins Plains solution. And it worked, at least as far as I was concerned. So the White House event taking place March of 2000. A very interesting thing happened. This was the same day the president was giving out the Medals of Science and Technology. At that, that was preceded this. What does he do for the Medal of Science and Technology? He turns to one of his staff, Jeff Smith, says, Jeff, get me a prop. Because Clinton wants to say, okay, props, the show. When Jeff goes out, what does he do? He gets from the Smithsonian, which we talked about, the coin, which I showed you on that first slide, 1792. And he brings it, he borrows it from the Smithsonian and hands it to Clinton to use at this medal ceremony. And Clinton begins the ceremony. This is before he gets to the Banter Collins thing. He holds the coin up to show people and makes a comment about the founding fathers and science. And he puts the coin back in his pocket. And they go through the rest of it. Everything ends. And the president walks out. And Jeff was running after him. Mr. President, the coin! And Clinton gets into an elevator, and Jeff says, the coin, the coin! And the president pulls it out of his pocket, throws it as the elevator doors close, and Jeff catches. Then comes the Collins veteran piece. That went off smoothly. But that morning, before this took place, this Joe Lockhart, the president's press secretary. So Lockhart is meeting with reporters, telling about this stuff that's going to happen with Benner and Collins and how everything's patched over and so on and so forth. And he says Blair and Clinton have come to an agreement that genes can't be patented. That was false. There was no such agreement.